She hadn't scared it away. It was afraid of people and houses. Jessie had been right about that. But she had underestimated its desperate condition. Its former name, Prince, was hideously ironic now. It had encountered a great many garbage bins just like the Burlingames in its long, starving circuit of Kashwakamak Lake this fall, and it had quickly dismissed the smell of salami, cheese, and olive oil coming from this one. The aroma was tantalizing, but bitter experience had taught the former Prince that the source of it was beyond its reach. There were other smells, however. The dog got a whiff of them each time the wind lazed the back door open. These smells were fainter than the ones coming from the box, and their source was inside the house, but they were too good to ignore. The dog knew it would probably be driven off by shouting masters who chased and kicked with their strange hard feet, but the smells were stronger than its fear. One thing might have countered its terrible hunger, but it as yet knew nothing of guns. That would change if it lived until deer season, but that was still 2 weeks away, and the shouting masters with their hard, hurtful feet were the worst thing it could imagine for now. It slipped through the door when the wind opened it and trotted into the entryway, but not too far. It was ready to beat a hasty retreat the instant danger threatened. Its ears told it that the inhabitant of this house was a bitch master, and she was clearly aware of the dog because she had shouted at it. But what the stray heard in the bitchmaster's raised voice was fear, not anger. After its initial backward jerk of fright, the dog stood its ground. It waited for some other master to join its cries to those of the bitchmaster or to come running, and when this didn't happen, the dog stretched its neck forward, sniffing at the slightly stale air of the house. At first it turned to the right, in the direction of the kitchen. It was from this direction that the puffs of scent dispersed by the flapping door had come. The smells were dry but pleasant. Peanut butter, rye crisp crackers, raisins, cereal. This latter smell was drifting from a box of Special K in one of the cupboards. A hungry field mouse had gnawed a hole in the bottom of the box. The dog took a step in that direction, then swung its head back the other way to make sure no master was creeping up on it. Masters most frequently shouted, but they could be sly, too. There was no one in the hallway leading down to the left, but the dog caught a much stronger scent coming from that direction, one that caused its stomach to cramp with terrible longing. The dog stared down the hall, its eyes sparkling with a mad mixture of fear and desire, its snout wrinkled backward like a rumpled throw rug, its long upper lip rising and falling in a nervous, spasmodic sneer that revealed its teeth in small white winks. A stream of anxious urine squirted from it and pattered on the floor, marking the front hall and thus the whole house as the dog's territory. This sound was too small and too brief for even Jessie's straining ears to catch. What it smelled was blood. The scent was both strong and wrong. In the end, the dog's extreme hunger tipped the scales. It must eat soon or die. The former prince began to walk slowly down the hall toward the bedroom. The smell grew stronger as it went. It was blood, all right, but it was the wrong blood. It was the blood of a master. Nevertheless, that smell, one far too rich and compelling to deny, had gotten into its small, desperate brain. The dog kept walking, and as it neared the bedroom door, it began to growl. Jessie heard the click of the dog's nails and understood it was indeed still in the house, and coming this way. She began to scream. She knew this was probably the worst thing a person could do. It went against all the advice she'd ever heard about never showing a potentially dangerous animal that you were afraid, but she couldn't help it. She had too good an idea of what was drawing the stray toward the bedroom. She pulled her legs up, using the handcuffs to yank herself back against the headboard at the same time. Her eyes never left the door to the hallway as she did this. Now she could hear the dog growling. The sound made her bowels feel loose and hot and liquid. It halted in the doorway. Here the shadows had already begun to gather, and to Jessie the dog was only a vague shape low to the floor, not a big one, but no toy poodle or chihuahua either. Two orange-yellow crescents of reflected sunlight marked its eyes. "Go away!" Jesse screamed at it. "Go away! Get out! You're not welcome here!" That was a ridiculous thing to say, but under the circumstances, what wasn't? "I'll be asking it to fetch me the keys from the top of the dresser before you know it," she thought. There was a movement from the hindquarters of the shadowy shape in the doorway. It had begun to wag its tail. In some sentimental girl's novel, this probably would have meant the stray had confused the voice of the woman on the bed with the voice of some beloved but long-lost master. Jesse knew better. Dogs didn't just wag their tails when they were happy. They, like cats, also wagged them when they were indecisive, still trying to evaluate a situation. The dog had barely flinched at the sound of her voice, but it didn't quite trust the dim room, either. Not yet, at least. The former prince had yet to learn about guns, but it had learned a good many other hard lessons in the 6 weeks or so since the last day of August. That was when Mr. Charles Sutlin, a lawyer from Braintree, Massachusetts, had turned it out in the woods to die rather than take it back home and pay a combined state and town dog tax of $70. $70 for a pooch which was nothing but a Heinz 57 was a pretty tall set of tickets, in Charles Sutlin's opinion. A little too tall. He had bought a motor sailor for himself only that June, granted, a purchase that was well up in the five-figure range. And you could claim that there was some fucked-up thinking going on if you compared the price of the boat and the price of the dog tag. Of course you could. Anybody could. But that wasn't really the point. The point was that the motor sailor had been a planned purchase. That particular acquisition had been on the old Sutlin drawing board for 2 years or more. The dog, on the other hand, was just a spur-of-the-moment buy at a roadside vegetable stand in Harlow. He never would have bought it if his daughter hadn't been with him and fallen in love with the pup. "That one, Daddy," she said, pointing. "The one with a white spot on his nose. The one that's standing all by himself like a little prince." So he'd bought her the pup. No one ever said he didn't know how to make his little girl happy. But $70, maybe as much as 100 if Prince was classified as a Class B larger dog, was serious dough when you were talking about a mutt that had come without a single piece of paperwork. Too much dough, Mr. Charles Sutlin had decided, as the time to close up the cottage on the lake for another year began to approach. Taking it back to Braintree in the back seat of the Saab would also be a pain in the ass. It would shed everywhere, might even puke or take a shit on the carpeting. He could buy it a very kennel, he supposed, but those little beauts started at $29.95 and worked up from there. A dog like Prince wouldn't be happy in a kennel anyway. He would be happier running wild, with a whole North Woods for his kingdom. Yes, Sutlin had told himself on that last day of August, as he parked on a deserted stretch of Bay Lane, and then coaxed the dog out of the back seat. Old Prince had the heart of a happy wanderer. You only had to take a good close look at him to see that. Sutton wasn't a stupid man, and part of his mind knew this was self-serving bullshit. But part of his mind was also exalted by the idea of it. And as he got back into his car and drove off, leaving Prince standing at the side of the road and looking after him, he was whistling the theme from Born Free, occasionally bursting into a snatch of the lyrics. "Born free, to follow your heart." He had slept well that night, not sparing a thought for Prince, soon to be the former Prince, who had spent the same night curled up beneath a fallen tree, shivering and wakeful and hungry, whining with fear each time an owl hooted or an animal moved in the woods. Now the dog Charles Sutlin had turned out to the theme of Born Free stood in the doorway of the master bedroom of the Burlingame summer home. The Sutlin cottage was on the far side of the lake, and the two families had never met, although they had exchanged casual nods at the town boat dock over the last 3 or 4 summers. Its head was down, its eyes were wide, and its hackles were up. It was unaware of its own steady growl. All of its concentration was focused on the room. It understood in some deep instinctual way that the blood smell would soon overwhelm all caution. Before that happened, it must assure itself as completely as it could that this was not a trap. It didn't want to be caught by masters with hard, hurtful feet, or by those who picked up hard pieces of the ground and threw them.
Go away!
Jessie tried to shout, but her voice came out sounding weak and trembly. She wasn't going to make the dog go away by shouting at it. The bastard somehow knew she couldn't get up off the bed and hurt it. This can't be happening, she thought. How could it be? When just 3 hours ago I was in the passenger seat of the Mercedes with my seatbelt around me, listening to the Rainmakers on the tape player, and reminding myself to see what was playing at the Mountain Valley Cinemas, just in case we decided to spend the night. How can my husband be dead when we were singing along with Bob Walkenhorst? One more summer, we sang. One more chance, one more stab at romance. We both know all the words to that one because it's a great one, and that being the case, how can Gerald possibly be dead? How can things have possibly gotten from there to here? Sorry, folks, but this just has to be a dream. It's much too absurd for reality. The stray began to advance slowly into the room, legs stiff with caution, tail drooping, eyes wide and black, lips peeled back to reveal a full complement of teeth. About such concepts as absurdity, it knew from nothing. The former prince with whom the 8-year-old Catherine Sutlin had once romped joyfully, at least until she'd gotten a Cabbage Patch doll named Marnie for her birthday and temporarily lost some of her interest, was part lab and part collie. A mixed breed, but a long way from being a mongrel. When Sutlin had turned it out on Bay Lane at the end of August, it had weighed 80 pounds, and its coat had been glossy and sleek with health, a not unattractive mixture of brown and black, with a distinctive white collie bib on the chest and undersnout. It now weighed a bare 40 pounds, and a hand passed down its side would have felt each straining rib, not to mention the rapid, feverish beat of its heart. Its coat was dull and bedraggled and full of burdocks. A half-healed pink scar, souvenir of a panicky scramble under a barbed wire fence, zigzagged down one haunch, and a few porcupine quills stuck out of its muzzle like crooked whiskers. It had found the porker lying dead under a log about 10 days ago, but had given up on it after the first noseful of quills. It had been hungry, but not yet desperate. Now it was both. Its last meal had been a few maggoty scraps nosed out of a discarded garbage bag in a ditch running beside Route 117, and that had been 2 days ago. The dog which had quickly learned to bring Catherine Sutlin a red rubber ball when she rolled it across the living room floor or into the hall was now quite literally starving on its feet. Yes, but here, right here on the floor, within sight, were pounds and pounds of fresh meat and fat and bones filled with sweet marrow. It was like a gift from the god of strays. The one-time darling of Catherine Sutlin continued to advance on the corpse of Gerald Burlingame. This isn't going to happen, Jessie told herself. No way it can, so just relax. She went on telling herself this right up to the moment when the upper half of the stray's body was cut off from her view by the left side of the bed. Its tail began to wag harder than ever, and then there was a sound she recognized, the sound of a dog drinking from a puddle on a hot summer day. Except it wasn't quite like that. This sound was rougher somehow, not so much the sound of lapping as of licking. Jessie stared at the rapidly wagging tail, and her mind suddenly showed her what was hidden from her eyes by the angle of the bed. This homeless stray, with its burdock-tangled fur and its weary, wary eyes, was licking the blood out of her husband's thinning hair.
No!
She lifted her buttocks off the bed and swung her legs around to the left.
Get away from him! Just get away!
She kicked out, and one of her heels brushed across the raised knobs of the dog's spine. It pulled back instantly and raised its muzzle, its eyes so wide they showed delicate rings of white. Its teeth parted, and in the fading afternoon light the cobweb-thin strands of saliva stretched between its upper and lower incisors looked like threads of spun gold. It lunged forward at her bare foot. Jessie yanked it back with a scream, feeling the hot mist of the dog's breath on her skin but saving her toes. Jessie curled her legs under her again without being aware she was doing it, without hearing the cries of outrage from the muscles in her overstrained shoulders, without feeling her joints roll reluctantly in their bony beds. The dog looked at her a moment longer, continuing to snarl, threatening her with its eyes.
"Let's have an understanding, lady," the eyes said. "You do your thing and I'll do mine. That's the understanding. Sound okay to you? It better, because if you get in my way, I'm going to fuck you up. Besides, he's dead. You know it as well as I do. And why should he go to waste when I'm starving? You do the same. I doubt if you see that now, but I believe you may come around to my way of thinking on the subject, and sooner than you think."
"Get out!"
she screamed. Now she sat on her heels, with her arms stretched out to either side, looking more like Fay Wray on the sacrificial jungle altar than ever. Her posture, head up, breasts thrust outward, shoulders thrown so far back they were white with strain at their furthest points, deep triangular hollows of shadow at the base of her neck, was that of an exceptionally hot pin-up in a girly magazine. The obligatory pout of sultry invitation was missing, however. The expression on her face was that of a woman who stands very near the borderline between the country of the sane and that of the mad.
"Get out of here!"
The dog continued to look up at her and snarl for a few moments. Then, when it had apparently assured itself that the kicks wouldn't be repeated, it dismissed her and lowered its head again. There was no lapping or licking this time. Jessie heard a loud smacking sound instead. It reminded her of the enthusiastic kisses her brother Will used to place on Grandma Joan's cheek when they went to visit. The growling continued for a few seconds, but it was now oddly muffled, as if someone had slipped a pillowcase over the stray's head. From her new sitting position, with her hair almost brushing the bottom of the shelf over her head, Jessie could see one of Gerald's plump feet, as well as his right arm and hand. The foot was shaking back and forth, as if Gerald was bopping a little to some jivey piece of music, "One More Summer" by the Rainmakers, for instance. She could see the dog better from her new vantage point. Its body was now visible all the way up to the place where its neck started. She would have been able to see its head, too, if it had been up. It wasn't, though. The stray's head was down, and its rear legs were stiffly braced. Suddenly there was a thick ripping sound, a snotty sound, like someone with a bad cold trying to clear his throat. She moaned.
"Stop. Oh, please, can't you stop?"
The dog paid no attention. Once it had sat up and begged for table scraps, its eyes appearing to laugh, its mouth appearing to grin. But those days, like its former name, were long gone and hard to find. This was now, and things were what they were. Survival was not a matter for politeness or apology. It hadn't eaten for 2 days. There was food here, and although there was also a master here who didn't want it to take the food, the days when there had been masters who laughed and patted its head and called it good dog and gave it scraps for doing its small repertoire of tricks were all gone. This master's feet were small and soft instead of hard and hurtful, and its voice said it was powerless. The former prince's growls changed to muffled pants of effort, and as Jessie watched, the rest of Gerald's body began to bop along with his foot, first just jiving back and forth, and then actually starting to slide, as if he had gotten all the way into the groove, dead or not.
"Get down, Disco Gerald," Jessie thought wildly. "Never mind the chicken or the shag. Do the dog!"
The stray couldn't have moved him if the rug had still been down, but Jessie had made arrangements to have the floor waxed the week after Labor Day. Bill Dunn, their caretaker, had let the men from Skip's Floors and More in, and they had done a hell of a job. They had wanted the missus to fully appreciate their work the next time she happened to stop down, so they had left the bedroom rug rolled up in the entry closet, and once the stray got Disco Gerald moving on the glossy floor, he moved almost as easily as John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever. The only real problem the dog had was keeping its own traction. Its long, dirty claws helped in this regard, digging in and inscribing short, jagged marks into the glossy wax as it backed up with its teeth buried to the gum lines in Gerald's flabby upper arm. I'm not seeing this, you know. None of this is really happening. Just a little while ago, we were listening to the Rainmakers, and Gerald turned down the volume long enough to tell me he was thinking about going up to Orono for the football game this Saturday. U of M against BU. I remember him scratching the lobe of his right ear while he talked. So how can he be dead, with a dog dragging him across our bedroom floor by the arm? Gerald's widow's peak was in disarray, probably as a result of the dog licking the blood out of it. But his glasses were still firmly in place. She could see his eyes, half open and glazed, glaring up at the fading sun ripples on the ceiling from their puffy sockets. His face was still a mask of ugly red and purple blotches, as if even death had not been able to assuage his anger at her sudden capricious. Had he seen it as capricious? Of course he had. Change of mind. "Let go of him," she told the dog. But her voice was now meek and sad and strengthless. The dog barely twitched its ears at the sound of it, and didn't pause at all. It merely went on pulling the thing with a disarrayed widow's peak and the blotchy complexion. This thing no longer looked like Disco Gerald, not a bit. Now it was only dead Gerald, sliding across the bedroom floor with a dog's teeth buried in its flabby biceps. A frayed flap of skin hung over the dog's snout. Jessie tried to tell herself it looked like wallpaper, but wallpaper did not, at least as far as she knew, come with moles and a vaccination scar. Now she could see Gerald's pink, fleshy belly, marked only by the small caliber bullet hole that was his navel. His penis flopped and dangled in its nest of black pubic hair. His buttocks whispered along the hardwood boards with ghastly, frictionless ease. Abruptly, the suffocating atmosphere of her terror was pierced by a shaft of anger so bright it was like a stroke of heat lightning inside her head. She did more than accept this new emotion. She welcomed it. Rage might not help her get out of this nightmare situation, but she sensed it would serve as an antidote to her growing sense of shocked unreality. "You bastard," she said in a low, trembling voice. "You cowardly, slinking bastard." Although she couldn't reach anything on Gerald's side of the bed shelf, Jessie found that by rotating her left wrist inside the handcuff so that her hand was pointing back over her shoulder, she could walk her fingers over a short stretch of the shelf on her own side. She couldn't turn her head enough to see the things she was touching. They were just beyond that hazy spot people call the corner of their eye, but it didn't really matter. She had a pretty good idea of what was up there. She patted her fingers back and forth, running their tips lightly over tubes of makeup, pushing a few farther back on the shelf, and knocking others off it. Some of these latter landed on the coverlet. Others bounced off the bed or her left thigh and landed on the floor. None of them were even close to the sort of thing she was looking for. Her fingers closed on a jar of Nivea face cream, and for a moment she allowed herself to think it might do the trick. But it was only a sample-sized jar, too small and light to hurt the dog, even if it had been made of glass instead of plastic. She dropped it back onto the shelf and resumed her blind search. At their farthest stretch, her exploring fingers encountered the rounded edge of a glass object that was by far the biggest thing she had touched. For a moment she couldn't place it, and then it came to her. The stein hanging on the wall was only one souvenir of Gerald's Alpha Grabahoe days. She was touching another one. It was an ashtray, and the only reason she hadn't placed it immediately was because it belonged on Gerald's end of the shelf, next to his glass of ice water. Someone, possibly Mrs. Dahl, the cleaning lady, possibly Gerald himself, had moved it over to her side of the bed. Maybe in the course of dusting the shelf, maybe to make room for something else. The reason didn't matter anyway. It was there, and right now that was enough. Jessie closed her fingers over its rounded edge, feeling two notches in it, cigarette parking spaces. She gripped the ashtray, drew her hand back as far as she could, then brought it forward again. Her luck was in, and she snapped her wrist down at the instant the handcuff chain snubbed tight, like a big league pitcher breaking off a curve. All of this was an act of pure impulse. The missile sought for, found, and thrown, before she had time to ensure the failure of the shot, by reflecting on how unlikely it was that a woman who had gotten a D in the archery mod of her 2-year college phys ed requirement could possibly hit a dog with an ashtray, especially when the dog was 15 feet away and the hand she was throwing with happened to be handcuffed to a bedpost. Nevertheless, she did hit it. The ashtray flipped over once in its flight, briefly revealing the Alpha Gamma Rho motto. She couldn't read it from where she lay, and didn't have to. The Latin words for service, growth, and courage were inscribed around a torch. The ashtray started to flip again, but crashed into the dog's straining, bony shoulders before it could roll all the way over. The stray gave a yip of surprise and pain, and Jessie felt a moment of violent, primitive triumph. Her mouth pulled wide, in an expression that felt like a grin and looked like a screech. She howled deliriously, arching her back and straightening her legs as she did. She was once again unaware of the pain in her shoulders, as cartilage stretched and joints which had long since forgotten the limberness of 21 were pressed almost to the point of dislocation. She would feel it all later, every move, jerk, and twist she had made. But for now she was transported with savage delight at the success of her shot, and felt that if she did not somehow express her triumphant delirium, she might explode. She drummed her feet on the coverlet and rocked her body from side to side, her sweaty hair flailing her cheeks and temples, the tendons in her throat standing out like fat wire. "Ha!" she cried. "I got you! Ha!" The dog jerked backward when the ashtray struck it, and jerked again when it bounced away and shattered on the floor. Its ears flattened at the change in the bitchmaster's voice. What it heard now was not fear, but triumph. Soon it would get off the bed and begin to deal out kicks with its strange, hard feet. The dog knew it would be hurt again, as it had been hurt before if it stayed there. It must run. It turned its head to make sure its path of retreat was still open, and the entrancing smell of fresh blood and meat struck it once more as it did so. The dog's stomach cramped, sour and imperative with hunger, and it whined uneasily. It was caught, perfectly balanced between two opposing directives, and it squirted out a fresh trickle of anxious urine. The smell of its own water, an odor that spoke of sickness and weakness instead of strength and confidence, added to its frustration and confusion, and it began to bark again. Jessie winced back from that splintery, unpleasant sound. She would have covered her ears if she could, and the dog sensed another change in the room. Something in the bitchmaster's scent had changed. Her alpha smell was fading while it was still new and fresh, and the dog began to sense that perhaps the blow it had taken across its shoulders did not mean that other blows were coming after all. The first blow had been more startling than painful, anyway. The dog took a tentative step toward the trailing arm it had dropped, toward the entrancingly thick reek of mingled blood and meat. It watched the bitchmaster carefully as it moved. Its initial assessment of the bitchmaster as either harmless, helpless, or both might have been wrong. It would have to be very careful. Jessie lay on the bed, now faintly aware of the throbbing in her shoulders, more aware that her throat really hurt now, most aware of all But ashtray or no ashtray, the dog was still here. In the first hot rush of her triumph, it had seemed a foregone conclusion to her that it must flee. But it had somehow stood its ground. Worse, it was now advancing again. Cautiously and warily, true, but advancing. She felt a swollen green sack of poison pulsing somewhere inside her. Bitter stuff, hateful as hemlock. She was afraid that if that sack burst, she would choke on her own frustrated rage.
Get out or I'll kill you. I don't know how, but I promise to God I will.
The dog stopped again, looking at her with a deeply uneasy eye.
That's right. You better pay attention to me, Jesse said. You just better, because I mean it. I mean every word.
Then her voice rose to a shout again, although it bled off into whispers in places as her overstrained voice began to short out.
I'll kill you. I will. I swear I will. So get out.
The dog which had once been little Catherine Sutland's prince looked from the bitchmaster to the meat, from the meat to the bitchmaster, from the bitchmaster to the meat once more. It came to the sort of decision Catherine's father himself would have called a compromise. It leaned forward, eyes rolling up to watch Jesse carefully at the same time, and seized the torn flap of tendon, fat, and gristle that had once been Gerald Burlingame's right bicep. Growling, it yanked backward. Gerald's arm came up. His limp fingers seemed to point through the east window at the Mercedes in the driveway.
Stop it!
Jessie shrieked. Her wounded voice now broke more frequently into that upper register where shrieks became gaspy falsetto whispers.
Haven't you done enough? Just leave him alone!
The stray paid no heed. It shook its head rapidly from side to side, as it had often done when it and Kathy Sutland played tug-of-war with one of its rubber toys. This, however, was no game. Curds of foam flew from the stray's jaws as it worked, shaking the meat off the bone. Gerald's carefully manicured hand swooped wildly back and forth in the air. Now he looked like a band conductor urging his musicians to pick up their tempo. Jesse heard that thick, throat-clearing sound again, and suddenly realized she had to vomit.
No, Jesse!
It was Ruth's voice, and it was full of alarm.
No, you can't do that! The smell might bring it to you. Bring it on you!
Jessie's face knotted into a stressful grimace as she struggled to bring her gorge under control. The ripping sound came again, and she caught just a glimpse of the dog. Its forepaws were once again stiff and braced, and it seemed to stand at the end of a thick, dark strip of elastic the color of a ball jar gasket, before she closed her eyes. She tried to put her hands over her face, temporarily forgetting in her distress that she was cuffed. Her hands stopped still at least 2 feet apart from each other, and the handcuff chains jingled. Jesse moaned. It was a sound that went beyond desperation and into despair. It sounded like giving up. She heard that wet, snotty ripping sound once more. It ended with another big, happy kiss smack. Jesse did not open her eyes. The stray began to back toward the hall door, its eyes never leaving the bitchmaster on the bed. In its jaws was a large, glistening chunk of Gerald Burlingame. If the master on the bed meant to try and take it back, it would make its move now. The dog could not think. At least not as human beings understand that word. But its complex network of instincts provided a very effective alternative to thought, and it knew that what it had done, and what it was about to do, constituted a kind of damnation. But it had been hungry for a long time. It had been left in the woods by a man who had gone back home whistling the theme from Born Free, and now it was starving. If the bitchmaster tried to take away its meal now, it would fight. It took one final look at her, saw she was making no move to get off her bed, and turned away. It carried the meat into the entry and settled down with it caught firmly between its paws. The wind gusted briefly, first breezing the door open and then banging it shut. The stray glanced briefly in that direction and ascertained in its doggy, not quite thinking way that it could push the door open with its muzzle and escape quickly if the need arose. With this last piece of business taken care of, it began to eat. The urge to vomit passed slowly, but it did pass. Jessie lay on her back with her eyes pressed tightly shut, now beginning to really feel the painful throbbing in her shoulders. It came in slow, peristaltic waves, and she had a dismaying idea that this was only the beginning. "I want to go to sleep," she thought. It was the child's voice again. Now it sounded shocked and frightened. It had no interest in logic, no patience for cans and can'ts. "I was almost asleep when the bad dog came, and that's what I want now, to go to sleep." She sympathized wholeheartedly. The problem was she didn't really feel sleepy anymore. She had just seen a dog tear a chunk out of her husband, and she didn't feel sleepy at all. What she felt was thirsty. Jessie opened her eyes, and the first thing she saw was Gerald, lying on his own reflection in the highly polished bedroom floor like some grotesque human atoll. His eyes were still open, still staring furiously up at the ceiling. But his glasses now hung askew, with one bow sticking into his ear instead of going over it. His head was cocked at such an extreme angle that his plump left cheek lay almost against his left shoulder. Between his right shoulder and right elbow, there was nothing but a dark red smile with ragged white edges. "Dear Jesus," Jessie muttered. She looked quickly away, out the west window. Golden light, it was almost sunset light now, dazzled her, and she shut her eyes again, watching the ebb and flow of red and black as her heart pushed membranes of blood through her closed lids. After a few moments of this, she noticed that the same darting patterns repeated themselves over and over again. It was almost like looking at protozoa under a microscope, protozoa on a slide which had been tinted with a red stain. She found this repeating pattern both interesting and soothing. She supposed you didn't have to be a genius to understand the appeal such simple repeating shapes held, given the circumstances. When all the normal patterns and routines of a person's life fell apart, and with such shocking suddenness, you had to find something you could hold on to, something that was both sane and predictable. If the organized swirl of blood in the thin sheaths of skin between your eyeballs and the last sunlight of an October day was all you could find, then you took it and said thank you very much. Because if you couldn't find something to hold on to, something that made at least some sort of sense, the alien elements of the New World Order were apt to drive you quite mad. Elements like the sounds now coming from the entry, for instance. The sounds that were a filthy, starving stray eating part of the man who had taken you to see your first Bergman film. The man who had taken you to the amusement park at Old Orchard Beach, coaxed you aboard that big Viking ship that swung back and forth in the air like a pendulum, then laughed until tears squirted out of his eyes when you said you wanted to go again. The man who once made love to you in the bathtub until you were literally screaming with pleasure. The man who was now sliding down that dog's gullet in gobs and chunks. Alien elements like that. "Strange days, pretty mama," she said. "Strange days indeed." Her speaking voice had become a dusty, painful croak. She supposed she would do well to just shut up and give it a rest. But when it was quiet in the bedroom, she could hear the panic, still there, still creeping around on the big, soft pads of its feet, looking for an opening, waiting for her to let down her guard. Besides, there was no real quiet. The chainsaw guy had packed it in for the day. But the loon still voiced its occasional cry, and the wind was rising as sunset approached, banging the door more loudly, and more frequently than ever. Plus, of course, the sound of the dog dining on her husband. While Gerald had been waiting to collect and pay for the sub sandwiches at Amato's, Jessie had stepped next door to Michaud's market. The fish at Michaud's was always good, almost fresh enough to flop, as her grandmother would have said. She had bought a lovely filet of sole, thinking she would pan-broil it if they decided to stay overnight. Sole was good because Gerald, who would live on a diet of nothing but roast beef and fried chicken if left to his own devices, with the occasional order of deep-fried mushrooms thrown in for nutritional purposes, actually claimed to like sole. She had bought it without the slightest premonition that he would be eaten before he could eat. "It's a jungle out there, baby," Jessie said in her dusty, croaky voice, and realized she was now doing more than just thinking in Ruth Neary's voice. She actually sounded like Ruth, who in their college days would have lived on a diet of nothing but Dewars and Marlboros if left to her own devices. That tough, no-bullshit voice spoke up then, as if Jessie had rubbed a magic lamp. "Remember that Nick Lowe song you heard on WBLM when you were coming home from your pottery class one day last winter? The one that made you laugh?" She did. She didn't want to, but she did. It had been a Nick Lowe tune titled, "She Used to Be a Winner, Now She's Just the Doggie's Dinner." A cynically amusing pop meditation on loneliness, set to an incongruously sunny beat. Amusing as hell last winter, yes, Ruth was right about that. But not so amusing now. "Stop it, Ruth," she croaked. "If you're going to freeload in my head, at least have the decency to quit teasing me." "Teasing you? Jesus, Tootsie, I'm not teasing you. I'm trying to wake you up." "I am awake," she said querulously. On the lake, the loon cried out again, as if to back her up on that. "Partly thanks to you." "No, you're not. You haven't been awake, really awake, for a long time. When something bad happens, Jess, do you know what you do? You tell yourself, 'Oh, this is nothing to worry about. This is just a bad dream. I get them every now and then. They're no big deal. And as soon as I roll over on my back again, I'll be fine.' And that's what you do, you poor sap. That's just what you do." Jessie opened her mouth to reply. Such canards should not go unanswered, dry mouth and sore throat or not. But Goodwife Burlingame had mounted the ramparts before Jessie herself could do more than begin to organize her thoughts. "How can you say such awful things? You're horrible! Go away!" Ruth's no-bullshit voice uttered its cynical bark of laughter again, and Jessie thought how disquieting, how horribly disquieting it was to hear part of your mind laughing in the make-believe voice of an old acquaintance who was long gone to God knew where. "Go away? You'd like that, wouldn't you, Tootsie Wootsie Pie, Daddy's little girl? Any time the truth gets too close, any time you start to suspect the dream is maybe not just a dream, you run away." "That's ridiculous." "Is it? Then what happened to Nora Callaghan?" For a moment that shocked Goody's voice, and her own, the one that usually spoke both aloud and in her mind as "I," to silence. But in that silence a strange, familiar image formed. A circle of laughing, pointing people, mostly women, standing around a young girl with her head and hands in stocks. She was hard to see because it was very dark. It should have still been full daylight, but was for some reason very dark just the same. But the girl's face would have been hidden even if the day had been bright. Her hair hung over it like a penitent's shroud, although it was hard to believe she could have done anything too horrible. She was clearly no more than 12 or so. Whatever it was she was being punished for, it couldn't be for hurting her husband. This particular daughter of Eve was too young to have even begun her monthly courses, let alone have a husband. "No, that's not true." A voice from the deeper ranges of her mind suddenly spoke up. This voice was both musical yet frighteningly powerful, like the cry of a whale.
She started when she was only 10 and a half. Maybe that was the problem. Maybe he smelled blood just like that dog out in the entry. Maybe it made him frantic.
Shut up! Jessie cried. She felt suddenly frantic herself. Shut up! We don't talk about that!
And speaking of smells, what's that other one? Ruth asked. Now the mental voice was harsh and eager. The voice of a prospector who has finally stumbled over a vein of ore he has long suspected but never been able to find. That mineral smell, like salt and old pennies.
We don't talk about that, I said.
She lay on the coverlet, her muscles tense beneath her cold skin, both her captivity and her husband's death forgotten, at least for the time being, in the face of this new threat. She could feel Ruth, or some cut-off part of her for which Ruth spoke, debating whether or not to pursue the matter. When it decided not to, not directly at least, both Jessie and Goodwife Burlingame breathed a sigh of relief.
All right, let's talk about Nora instead, Ruth said. Nora, your therapist? Nora, your counselor? The one you started to go see around the time you stopped painting, because some of the paintings were scaring you. Which was also the time, coincidentally or not, when Gerald's sexual interest in you seemed to evaporate, and you started sniffing the collars of his shirts for perfume. You remember Nora, don't you?
Nora Callaghan was a prying bitch, the good wife snarled.
No, Jessie muttered. She was well-intentioned. I don't doubt that a bit. She just always wanted to go one step too far. Ask one question too many.
You said you liked her a lot. Didn't I hear you say that?
I want to stop thinking, Jessie said. Her voice was wavery and uncertain. I especially want to stop hearing voices and talking back to them, too. It's nuts.
Well, you'd better listen just the same, Ruth said grimly. Because you can't run away from this the way you ran away from Nora. The way you ran away from me, for that matter.
I never ran away from you, Ruth!
Shocked denial, and not very convincing. She had done just that, of course. Had simply packed her bags and moved out of the cheesy but cheerful dorm suite she and Ruth shared. She hadn't done it because Ruth had started asking her too many of the wrong questions. Questions about Jessie's childhood. Questions about Dark Score Lake. Questions about what might have happened there during the summer just after Jessie started to menstruate. No, only a bad friend would have moved out for such reasons. Jessie hadn't moved out because Ruth started asking questions. She moved out because Ruth wouldn't stop asking them when Jessie asked her to do so. That, in Jessie's opinion, made Ruth a bad friend. Ruth had seen the lines Jessie had drawn in the dust, and had then deliberately stepped over them anyway, as Nora Callaghan had done years later. Besides, the idea of running away under these conditions was pretty ludicrous, wasn't it? She was, after all, handcuffed to the bed.
Don't insult my intelligence, cutie pie, Ruth said. Your mind isn't handcuffed to the bed, and we both know it. You can still run if you want to. But my advice, my strong advice, is don't you do it. Because I'm the only chance you've got. If you just lie there pretending this is a bad dream you got from sleeping on your left side, you're going to die in handcuffs. Is that what you want? Is that your prize for living your whole life in handcuffs ever since?
I will not think about that!
Jessie screamed at the empty room. For a moment, Ruth was silent. But before Jessie could do more than begin to hope that she'd gone away, Ruth was back. And back at her, worrying her like a terrier worrying a rag.
Come on, Jess. You'd probably like to believe you're crazy, rather than dig around in that old grave. But you're really not, you know. I'm you,
The good wife's you, we're all you, as a matter of fact. I have a pretty good idea of what happened that day at Dark Score when the rest of the family was gone. And the thing I'm really curious about doesn't have a lot to do with the events per se. What I'm really curious about is this. Is there a part of you, one I don't know about, that wants to be sharing space with Gerald in that dog's guts come this time tomorrow? I only ask, because that doesn't sound like loyalty to me. That sounds like lunacy. Tears were trickling down her cheeks again, but she didn't know if she was crying because of the possibility, finally articulated, that she actually could die here, or because for the first time in at least 4 years, she had come close to thinking about that other summer place, the one on Dark Score Lake, and about what happened there on the day when the sun went out. Once upon a time, she had almost spilled that secret at a woman's consciousness group, back in the early 70s, that had been. And, of course, attending that meeting had been her roomie's idea. But Jessie had gone along willingly, at least to begin with. It had seemed harmless enough, just another act in the amazing tie-dyed carnival that was college back then. For Jessie, those first 2 years of college, particularly with someone like Ruth Neary to tour her through the games, rides, and exhibits, had been for the most part quite wonderful. A time when fearlessness seemed possible and achievement inevitable. Those were the days when no dorm room was complete without a Peter Max poster, and if you were tired of the Beatles, not that anybody was, you could slap on a little Hot Tuna or MC5. It had all been a little too bright to be real, like things seen through a fever which is not quite high enough to be life-threatening. In fact, those first 2 years had been a blast. The blast had ended with that first meeting of the Women's Consciousness Group. In there, Jessie had discovered a ghastly gray world which seemed simultaneously to preview the adult future that lay ahead for her in the 80s and to whisper of gloomy childhood secrets that had been buried alive in the 60s. But did not lie quiet there. There had been 20 women in the living room of the cottage attached to the Newworth Interdenominational Chapel, some perched on the old sofa, others peering out of the shadows thrown by the wings of the vast and lumpy parsonage chairs, most sitting cross-legged on the floor in a rough circle, 20 women between the ages of 18 and 40-something. They had joined hands and shared a moment of silence at the beginning of the session. When that was over, Jessie had been assaulted by ghastly stories of rape, of incest, and of physical torture. If she lived to be 100, she would never forget the calm, pretty blonde girl who had pulled up her sweater to show the old scars of cigarette burns on the undersides of her breasts. That was when the carnival ended for Jessie Mayhoot. Ended? No, that wasn't right, let alone fair. It was as if she had been afforded a momentary glimpse behind the carnival, had been allowed to see the gray and empty fields of autumn that were the real truth. Nothing but empty cigarette wrappers and used condoms, and a few cheap broken prizes caught in the tall grass, waiting to either blow away or be covered by the winter snows. She saw that silent, stupid, sterile world waiting beyond the thin layer of patched canvas, which was all that separated it from the razzle-dazzle brightness of the midway, the patter of hucksters, and the glimmer-glamour of the rides. And it terrified her. To think that only this lay ahead for her, only this and nothing more, was awful. To think that it lay behind her as well, imperfectly hidden by the patched and tawdry canvas of her own doctored memories, was insupportable. After showing them the bottoms of her breasts, the pretty blonde girl had pulled her sweatshirt back down and explained that she could say nothing to her parents about what her brother's friends had done to her on the weekend her parents had gone to Montreal, because it might mean that what her brother had been doing to her off and on all during the last year would come out, and her parents would never have believed that. The blonde girl's voice was as calm as her face, her tone perfectly rational. When she finished, there was a moment of thunderstruck silence, a moment during which Jessie had felt something tearing loose inside her, and had heard 100 ghostly interior voices screaming in mingled hope and terror. And then Ruth had spoken. "Why wouldn't they believe you?" she demanded. "Jesus, Liv, they burned you with live cigarettes. I mean, you had the burns as evidence. Why wouldn't they believe you? Didn't they love you?" Yes, Jessie thought. Yes, they loved her, but... "Yes," the blonde girl said. "They loved me. They still do. But they idolized my brother Barry." Sitting beside Ruth, the heel of one not quite steady hand resting against her forehead, Jessie remembered whispering, "Besides, it would have killed her." Ruth turned to her, began, "What?" And the blonde girl, still not crying, still eerily calm, said, "Besides, finding out something like that would have killed my mother." And then Jessie had known she was going to explode if she didn't get out of there. So she had gotten up, springing out of her chair so fast she had almost knocked the ugly, bulky thing over. She had sprinted from the room, knowing they were all looking at her, not caring. What they thought didn't matter. What mattered was that the sun had gone out, the very sun itself. And if she told, her story would be disbelieved only if God was good. If God was in a bad mood, Jessie would be believed. And even if it didn't kill her mother, it would blow the family apart like a stick of dynamite in a rotten pumpkin. So she had run out of the room and through the kitchen, and would have belted right on through the back door, except the back door was locked. Ruth chased after her, calling for her to stop. "Jessie, stop." She had, but only because that damned locked door made her. She'd put her face against the cold, dark glass, actually considering, yes, just for a moment she had, slamming her head right through it and cutting her throat. Anything to blot out that awful gray vision of the future ahead and the past behind. But in the end, she had simply turned around and slid down to the floor, clasping her bare legs below the hem of the short skirt she'd been wearing, and putting her forehead against her upraised knees and closing her eyes. Ruth sat down beside her and put an arm around her, rocking her back and forth, crooning to her, stroking her hair, encouraging her to give it up, get rid of it, sick it up, let it go. Now, lying here in the house on the shore of Kashwakamok Lake, she wondered what had happened to the tearless, eerily calm blonde girl who had told them about her brother Barry and Barry's friends, young men who had clearly felt a woman was just a life support system for a cunt, and that branding was a perfectly just punishment for a young woman who felt more or less okay about fucking her brother, but not her brother's good buddies. More to the point, Jessie wondered what she had said to Ruth as they sat with their backs against the locked kitchen door and their arms around each other. The only thing she could remember for sure was something like, "He never burned me. He never burned me. He never hurt me at all." But there must have been more to it than that, because the questions Ruth had refused to stop asking had all pointed clearly in just one direction, toward Dark Score Lake, and the day the sun had gone out. She had finally left Ruth rather than tell, just as she had left Nora rather than tell.
She had run just as fast as her legs could carry her. Jessie Mayhoot Burlingame, also known as the Amazing Gingerbread Girl, the last wonder of a dubious age, survivor of the day the sun had gone out, now handcuffed to the bed and able to run no more. "Help me," she said to the empty bedroom. Now that she had remembered the blonde girl with the eerily calm face and voice, and the stipple of old circular scars on her otherwise lovely breast, Jessie could not get her out of her mind, nor the knowledge that it hadn't been calmness, not at all, but some fundamental disconnection from the terrible thing that had happened to her. Somehow the blonde girl's face became her face, and when Jessie spoke, she did so in the shaking, humbled voice of an atheist who has been stripped of everything but one final, long-shot prayer. "Please, help me." It wasn't God who answered, but the part of her which could apparently only speak while masquerading as Ruth Neary. The voice now sounded gentle, but not very hopeful. "I'll try. But you have to help me. I know you're willing to do painful things, but you may have to think painful thoughts, too. Are you ready for that?" "This isn't about thinking," Jessie said shakily, and thought. So that's what the Good Wife Burlingame sounds like out loud. It's about, well, escaping. "And you may have to muzzle her," Ruth said. "She's a valid part of you, Jessie, of us, and not really a bad person. But she's been left to run the whole show for far too long, and in a situation like this, her way of dealing with the world is not much good. Do you want to argue the point?" Jessie didn't want to argue that point or any other. She was too tired. The light falling through the west window was growing steadily hotter and redder as sunset approached. The wind gusted, sending leaves rattling along the lakeside deck, which was empty now. All the deck furniture had been stacked in the living room. The pines soft. The back door banged. The dog paused, then resumed its noisome smacking and ripping and chewing. "I'm so thirsty," she said mournfully. "Okay, then. That's where we ought to start." She turned her head the other way until she felt the last warmth of the sun on the left side of her neck, and the damp hair stuck to her cheek, and then she opened her eyes again. She found herself staring directly at Gerald's glass of water, and her throat immediately sent out a parched, imperative cry. "Let's begin this phase of operations by forgetting about the dog," Ruth said. "The dog is just doing what it has to do to get along. And you've got to do the same." "I don't know if I can forget it," Jessie said. "I think you can, Toots. I really do. If you could sweep what happened on the day the sun went out under the rug, I guess you can sweep anything under the rug." For a moment, she almost had it all, and understood she could have it all if she really wanted to. The secret of that day had never been completely sunk in her subconscious, as such secrets were in the TV soap operas and the movie melodramas. It had been buried in a shallow grave at best. There had been some selective amnesia, but of a completely voluntary sort. If she wanted to remember what had happened on the day the sun had gone out, she thought she probably could. As if this idea had been an invitation, her mind's eye suddenly saw a vision of heartbreaking clarity. A pane of glass held in a pair of barbecue tongs. A hand wearing an oven mitt was turning it this way and that in the smoke of a small sod fire. Jessie stiffened on the bed and willed the image away. "Let's get one thing straight," she thought. She supposed it was the Ruth voice she was speaking to, but wasn't completely sure. She wasn't really sure of anything anymore. "I don't want to remember. Got it? The events of that day have nothing to do with the events of this one. They're apples and oranges. It's easy enough to understand the connections. Two lakes,
two summer houses,
two cases of secret
silence,
hurt, harm, sexual hanky-panky. But remembering what happened in 1963 can't do a thing for me now except add to my general misery. So let's just drop that whole subject, okay? Let's just forget Dark Score Lake. What do you say, Ruth?
She asked in a low voice,
and her gaze shifted to the batik butterfly across the room. For just a moment, there was another image. A little girl. Somebody's sweet little pumpkin, smelling the sweet aroma of aftershave, and looking up into the sky through a piece of smoked glass. And then it was mercifully gone. She looked at the butterfly for a few moments longer, wanting to make sure those old memories were going to stay gone. And then she looked back at Gerald's glass of water. Incredibly, there were still a few slivers of ice floating on top, although the darkening room continued to hold the heat of the afternoon sun, and would for a while longer. Jessie let her gaze drip down the glass, let it embrace those chilly bubbles of condensation standing out on it. She couldn't actually see the coaster on which the glass stood. The shelf cut it off. But she didn't have to see it to visualize the dark, spreading ring of moisture forming on it, as those cool beads of condensate continued to trickle down the sides of the glass and pool around it at the bottom. Jessie's tongue slipped out and swiped across her upper lip, not imparting much moisture.
"I want a drink!"
The scared, demanding voice of the child, of somebody's sweet little pumpkin, yelled.
"I want it! And I want it right now!"
But she couldn't reach the glass. It was a clear-cut case of so near and yet so far. "Ruth, don't give up so easy. If you could hit the goddamn dog with an ashtray, Tootsie, maybe you can get the glass. Maybe you can." Jessie raised her right hand again, straining as hard as her throbbing shoulder would allow, and still came up at least 2.5 inches short. She swallowed, grimacing at the sandpapery jerk and clench of her throat. "See?" she asked. "Are you happy now?" Ruth didn't reply, but Goody did. She spoke up softly, almost apologetically, inside Jessie's head. "She said, get it, not reach it. They might not be the same thing." Goody laughed in an embarrassed, "Who am I to stick my oar in way?" And Jessie had a moment to think again, how surpassingly odd it was to feel a part of yourself laughing like that, as if it really was an entirely separate entity. "If I had a few more voices," Jessie thought, "we could have a goddamn bridge tournament in here." She looked at the glass a moment longer, then let herself flop back down on the pillows so she could study the underside of the shelf. It wasn't attached to the wall, she saw. It lay on 4 steel brackets that looked like upside-down capital L's. And the shelf wasn't attached to them, either. She was sure of it. She remembered once when Gerald had been talking on the phone, and had absent-mindedly attempted to lean on the shelf. Her end had started to come up, levitating like the end of a seesaw. And if Gerald hadn't snapped his hand away immediately, he would have flipped the shelf like a tiddlywink. The thought of his telephone distracted her for a moment, but only a moment. It sat on a low table in front of the east window, the one with its scenic view of the driveway and the Mercedes, and it might as well have been on another planet for all the good it could do her in her current situation. Her eyes returned to the underside of the shelf, first studying the plank itself, then scanning the L-shaped brackets again. When Gerald leaned on his end, her end had tilted. If she could exert enough pressure on her end to tilt his, the glass of water, "It might slide down," she said in a hoarse, musing voice. "It might slide down to my end. Of course, it might go sliding gaily right past her to shatter on the floor. And it might bang into some unseen obstacle up there, and overturn before it ever got to her. But it was worth trying, wasn't it? Sure, I guess so, she thought. I mean, I was planning to fly to New York in my Lear jet, eat at Four Seasons, dance the night away at Birdland. But with Gerald dead, I guess that would be a little tacky. And with all the good books currently out of reach, all the bad ones, too, as far as that goes, I guess I might as well try for the consolation prize. All right. How was she supposed to go about it? Very carefully, she said.
That's how.
She used the handcuffs to pull herself up again and studied the glass the more. Not being able to actually see the surface of the shelf now struck her as a drawback. She had a pretty good idea of what was on her end, but was less sure about Gerald's and the no man's land in the middle. Of course, it wasn't surprising. Who but someone with an eidetic memory could reel off a complete inventory of the items on a bedroom shelf? Who would ever have thought such things could matter? Well, they matter now. I'm living in a world where all the perspectives have changed. Yes, indeed. In this world, a stray dog could be scarier than Freddy Krueger. The phone was in the twilight zone. The sought-for desert oasis, goal of 1,000 grizzled foreign legionnaires in 100 desert romances, was a glass of water with a few last slivers of ice floating on top. In this new world order, the bedroom shelf had become a shipping lane as vital as the Panama Canal, and an old paperback western or mystery in the wrong place could become a lethal roadblock. "Don't you think you're exaggerating a little?" she asked herself uneasily. But in truth, she did not. This would be a long-odds operation under the best of circumstances. But if there was junk on the runway, forget it. A single skinny Hercule Poirot, or one of the Star Trek novels Gerald read and then dropped like used napkins, wouldn't show above the angle of the shelf. But it would be more than enough to stop or overturn the water glass. No, she wasn't exaggerating. The perspectives of this world really had changed, and enough to make her think of that science fiction movie where the hero started to shrink and went on getting smaller until he was living in his daughter's dollhouse and going in fear of the family cat. She was going to learn the new rules in a hurry, learn them and live by them. "Don't lose your courage, Jesse," Ruth's voice whispered. "Don't worry," she said. "I'm going to try. I really am. But sometimes it's good to know what you're up against. I think sometimes that makes a difference." She rotated her right wrist outward from her body as far as it would go, then raised her arm. In this position, she looked like a woman's shape in a line of Egyptian pictographs. She began to patter her fingers on the shelf again, feeling for obstructions along the stretch where she hoped the glass would finish up. She touched a piece of fairly heavy-gauge paper and thumbed it for a moment, trying to think what it could be. Her first guess was a sheet from the notepad that usually hid in the clutter on the telephone table, but it wasn't thin enough for that. Her eye happened on a magazine, either Time or Newsweek. Gerald had brought both along, lying face down beside the phone. She remembered him thumbing rapidly through one of the magazines while he took off his socks and unbuttoned his shirt. The piece of paper on the shelf was probably one of those annoying blow-in subscription cards with which the newsstand copies of magazines are always loaded. Gerald often laid such cards aside for later use as bookmarks. It might be something else, but Jessie decided it didn't matter to her plans in any case. It wasn't solid enough to stop the glass or overturn it. There was nothing else up there, at least within reach of her stretching, wriggling fingers. "Okay," Jessie said. Her heart had started to pound hard. Some sadistic pirate broadcaster in her mind tried to transmit a picture of the glass tumbling off the shelf, and she immediately blocked the image out. "Easy. Easy does it. Slow and easy wins the race. I hope." Holding her right hand right where it was,
although bending it away from her body in that direction didn't work very well and hurt like the devil. Jessie raised her left hand, my ashtray-throwing hand, she thought with a grim glint of humor, and gripped the shelf with it well beyond the last supporting bracket on her side of the bed. Here we go, she thought, and began to exert downward pressure with her left hand. Nothing happened. I'm probably pulling too close to that last bracket to get enough leverage. The problem is the goddamn handcuff chain. I don't have enough slack to get as far out on the shelf as I need to be. Probably true. But the insight didn't change the fact that she wasn't doing a thing to the shelf with her left hand where it was. She would have to spider her fingers out a little further, if she could, that was, and hope it would be enough. It was funny book physics, simple but deadly. The irony was that she could reach under the shelf and push it up any time she liked. There was one small problem with that, however. It would tip the glass the wrong way, off Gerald's end and onto the floor. When you considered it closely, you saw that the situation really did have its amusing side. It was like an America's Funniest Home Video segment sent in from hell. Suddenly the wind dropped, and the sound from the entry seemed very loud.
Are you enjoying him, shithead?
Jessie screamed. Pain ripped at her throat, but she didn't, couldn't stop.
I hope so, because the first thing I'm going to do when I get out of these cuffs is blow your head off.
Big talk, she thought. Very big talk for a woman who no longer even remembers if Gerald's old shotgun, the one that belonged to his dad, is here or in the attic of the Portland house. Nevertheless, there was a gratifying moment of silence from the shadowy world beyond the bedroom door. It was almost as if the dog was giving this threat its soberest, most thoughtful consideration. Then the smackings and chewings began again. Jessie's right wrist twanged warningly, threatening to cramp up, warning her that she had better get on with her business right away, if she actually had any business to do, that was. She leaned to the left and stretched her hand as far as the chain would allow. Then she began to put on the pressure again. At first there was nothing. She pulled harder, eyes slitted almost shut, the corners of her mouth turned down. It was the face of a child who expects a dose of bad medicine. And just before she reached the maximum downward pressure her aching arm muscles could exert, she felt a tiny shift on the shelf, a change in the uniform drag of gravity so minute that it was more intuitive than actually sensed. Wishful thinking, Jess. That's all you felt. Only that and nothing more. No. It was the input of senses which had been jacked into the stratosphere by terror, perhaps, but it wasn't wishful thinking. She let go of the shelf and just lay there for a few moments, taking long, slow breaths and letting her muscles recover. She didn't want them spasming or cramping up at the critical moment. She had quite enough problems without that, thanks. When she thought she felt as ready as she could feel, she curled her left fist loosely around the bedpost and slid it up and down until the sweat on her palm dried and the mahogany squeaked. Then she stretched out her arm and gripped the shelf again. It was time. Got to be careful, though. The shelf moved, no question about that, and it'll move more. But it's going to take all my strength to get that glass in motion. If I can do it at all, that is. And when a person gets near the end of their strength, control gets spotty. That was true, but it wasn't the kicker. The kicker was this. She had no feel for the shelf's tip point. Absolutely none at all. Jessie remembered seesawing with her sister Maddie on the playground behind Falmouth Grammar School. They had come back early from the lake one summer, and it seemed to her she had spent that whole August going up and down on those paint-peeling teeter boards with Maddie as her partner, and how they had been able to balance perfectly whenever they felt like it. All it took was for Maddie, We wait a little more to move a butt length in toward the middle. Long, hot afternoons of practice, singing jump rope songs to each other as they went up and down, had enabled them to find each seesaw's tip point with an almost scientific exactitude. Those half a dozen warped green boards standing in a row on the sizzling hot top had seemed almost like living things to them. She felt none of that eager liveliness under her fingers now. She would simply have to try her best and hope that it was good enough. And whatever the Bible may say to the contrary, don't let your left hand forget what your right hand is supposed to be doing. Your left may be your ashtray-throwing hand, but your right had better be your glass-catching hand, Jesse. There's only a few inches of shelf where you'll have a chance to get hold of it. If it slides past that area, it won't matter if it stays up. It'll be as out of reach as it is right now. Jesse didn't think she could forget what her right hand was doing. It hurt too much. Whether or not it would be able to do what she needed it to do was another question entirely, though. She had increased the pressure on the left side of the shelf as steadily and as gradually as she could. A stinging drop of sweat ran into the corner of one eye, and she blinked it away. Somewhere the back door was banging again, but it had joined the telephone in that other universe. Here there was only the glass, the shelf, and Jesse. Part of her expected the shelf to come up all at once like a brutal jack-in-the-box, catapulting everything off, and she tried to steel herself against the possible disappointment. Worry about that if it happens, Toots. In the meantime, don't lose your concentration. I think something's happening. Something was. She could feel that minute shift again, that feel of the shelf starting to come unanchored at some point along Gerald's side. This time, Jessie didn't let up her pressure, but increased it, the muscles in her upper left arm standing out in hard little arcs that trembled with strain. She voiced a series of small, explosive grunts. That sense of the shelf coming unanchored grew steadily stronger. And suddenly, the flat circular surface of the water in Gerald's glass was a tilted plane, and she heard the last slivers of ice chatter faintly as the right end of the board actually did come up. The glass itself did not move, however, and a horrible thought occurred to her. What if some of the water trickling down the sides of the glass had seeped beneath the cardboard coaster on which it sat? What if it had formed a seal, bonding it to the shelf? No, that can't happen. The words came out in a single whispered blurt, like a tired child's rote prayer. She pulled down harder on the left end of the shelf, using all her strength. Every last horse was now running in harness. The stable was empty. Please don't let it happen. Gerald's end of the shelf continued to rise, its end wavering wildly. A tube of Max Factor blush spilled off Jessie's end and landed on the floor near the place where Gerald's head had lain before the dog had come along and dragged him away from the bed. And now a new possibility, more of a probability, actually, occurred to her. If she increased the angle of the shelf much more, it would simply slide down the line of L-brackets, glass and all, like a toboggan going down a snowy hill. Thinking of the shelf as a seesaw could get her into trouble. It wasn't a seesaw. There was no central pivot point to which it was attached.
Slide, you bastard!
She screamed at the glass in a high, breathy voice. She had forgotten Gerald, had forgotten she was thirsty, had forgotten everything but the glass, now tilted at an angle so acute that the water was almost slopping over the rim, and she couldn't understand why it didn't simply fall over. It didn't, though. It just went on standing where it had stood all along, as if it had been glued to the spot.
Slide!
Suddenly, it did. Its movement ran so counter to her black imaginings that she was almost unable to understand what was happening. Later it would occur to her that the adventure of the sliding glass suggested something less than admirable about her own mindset. She had in some fashion or other been prepared for failure. It was success which left her shocked and gaping. The short, smooth journey of the glass down the shelf toward her right hand so stunned her that Jessie almost pulled harder with her left, a move that almost certainly would have overbalanced the precariously tilted shelf and sent it crashing to the floor. Then her fingers were actually touching the glass, and she screamed again. It was the wordless, delighted shriek of a woman who has just won the lottery. The shelf wavered, began to slip, then paused, as if it had a rudimentary mind of its own and was considering whether or not it really wanted to do this. "Not much time, Toots," Ruth warned. "Grab the goddamn thing while the grabbing's good." Jessie tried, but the pads of her fingers only slid along the slick, wet surface of the glass. There was nothing to grab, it seemed, and she couldn't quite get enough finger surface on the thrice-damned thing to grip. Water sloshed onto her hand, and now she sensed that even if the shelf held, the glass would soon tip over. "Imagination, Toots. Just the old idea that a sad little pumpkin like you can never do anything right." That wasn't far from the mark. It was certainly too close for comfort. But it wasn't on the mark. Not this time. The glass was getting ready to tip over. It really was. And she didn't have the slightest idea of what she could do to prevent that from happening. Why did she have to have such short, stubby, ugly fingers? Why? If only she could get them a little further around the glass. A nightmare image from some old TV commercial occurred to her. A smiling woman in a 50s hairdo, with a pair of blue rubber gloves on her hands. "So flexible, you can pick up a dime," the woman was screaming through her smile. "Too bad you don't have a pair, little pumpkin, or goodwife, or whoever the hell you are. Maybe you could get that fucking glass before everything on the goddamn shelf takes the express elevator." Jessie suddenly realized the smiling, screaming woman in the Playtex rubber gloves was her mother, and a dry sob escaped her. It was like some terrible omen that did not just suggest death, but guaranteed it. "Don't give up, Jessie," Ruth yelled. "Not yet. You're close. I swear you are." She exerted the last tiny scrap of her strength on the left side of the shelf, praying incoherently that it wouldn't slide. "Not yet. Oh, please, God, or whoever you are, please don't let it slide. Not now. Not yet." The board did slide, but only a little. Then it held again, perhaps temporarily snagged on a splinter or balked by a warp in the wood. The glass slid a little further into her hand, and now, crazier and crazier, it seemed to be talking too, the goddamn glass. It sounded like one of those grizzled big-city cab drivers who have a perpetual hard-on against the world. "Jesus, lady, what else you want me to do? Grow myself a goddamn handle and turn into a fucking pitcher for you?" A fresh trickle of water fell on Jessie's straining right hand. Now the glass would fall. Now it was inevitable. In her mind, she could already feel the freeze as ice water doused the back of her neck. "No!" She twisted her right shoulder a little farther, opened her right hand a little wider, let the glass slide a tiny bit deeper into the straining pocket of her hand. The cuff was digging cruelly into the back of that hand, sending jabs of pain all the way up to her elbow, but Jessie ignored them. The muscles of her left arm were twanging wildly now, and the shakes were communicating themselves to the tilted, unstable shelf. Another tube of makeup tumbled to the floor. The last few slivers of ice chimed faintly. Above the shelf, she could see the shadow of the glass on the wall. In the long sunset light, it looked like a grain silo blown a tilt by a strong prairie wind. More. Just a little bit more. There is no more. There better be. There's got to be. She stretched her right hand to its absolute tendon-creaking limit and felt the glass slide a tiny bit further down the shelf. Then she closed her fingers again, praying it would finally be enough, because now there really was no more. She had pushed her resources to their absolute limit. It almost wasn't. She could still feel the wet glass trying to squirm away. It had begun to seem like a live thing to her, a sentient being with a mean streak as wide as a turnpike passing lane. Its goal was to keep flirting toward her, and then squirming away until her sanity broke, and she lay here in the shadows of twilight, handcuffed and raving.
Don't let it get away, Jesse. Don't you dare let that fucking glass get away.
And although there was no more, not a single foot-pound of pressure, not a single quarter inch of stretch, she managed a little more anyway, turning her right wrist one final bit in toward the board. And this time, when she curved her fingers around the glass, it remained motionless.
I think maybe I've got it. Not for sure, but maybe. Maybe.
Or maybe it was just that she had finally gotten to the wishful thinking part. She didn't care. Maybe this and maybe that, and none of the maybes mattered anymore, and that was actually a relief. The certainty was this. She couldn't hold the shelf any longer. She had only tilted it 3 or 4 inches anyway, 5 at the most, but it felt as if she had bent down and picked up the whole house by one corner. That was the certainty. She thought, everything is perspective, and the voices that describe the world to you, I suppose, they matter. The voices inside. With an incoherent prayer that the glass would remain in her hand when the shelf was no longer there to support it, she let go with her left hand. The shelf banged back onto its brackets, only slightly askew, and shifted only an inch or two down to the left. The glass did stay in her hand, and now she could see the coaster. It clung to the bottom of the glass like a flying saucer. Please, God, don't let me drop it now. Don't let me drop... A cramp knotted her left arm, making her jerk back against the headboard. Her face knotted as well, pinching inward until the lips were a white scar and the eyes were agonized slits. Wait, it will pass. It will pass. Yes, of course it would. She'd had enough muscle cramps in her life to know that. But in the meantime, oh God, it hurt. If she had been able to touch the biceps of her left arm with her right hand, she knew that the skin there would feel as if it had been stretched over a number of small, smooth stones and then sewn up again with cunning, invisible thread. It didn't feel like a Charlie horse. It felt like rigor fucking mortis. No, just a Charlie horse, Jesse. Just like the one you had earlier. Wait it out, that's all. Wait it out, and for Christ's sweet sake, don't drop that glass of water. She waited. And after an eternity or two, the muscles in her arm began to relax, and the pain began to ease. Jesse breathed out a long, harsh sigh of relief, then prepared to drink her reward. Drink, yes, Goody thought. But I think you owe yourself a little more than just a nice, cool drink, my dear. Enjoy your reward, but enjoy it with dignity. No piggy gulping. Goody, you never change, she thought. But when she raised the glass, she did so with the stately calm of a guest at a court dinner, ignoring the alkali dryness along the roof of her mouth and the bitter pulse of thirst in her throat. Because you could put Goody down all you wanted, she practically begged for it sometimes. But behaving with a little dignity under these circumstances, especially under these circumstances, wasn't such a bad idea. She had worked for the water. Why not take the time to honor herself by enjoying it? That first cold sip sliding over her lips and coiling across the hot rug of her tongue was going to taste like victory. And after the run of lousy luck she'd just been through, that would indeed be a taste to savor. Jessie brought the glass toward her mouth, concentrating on the wet sweetness just ahead, the drenching downpour. Her taste buds cramped with anticipation, her toes curled, and she could feel a furious pulse beating beneath the angle of her jaw. She realized her nipples had hardened, as they sometimes did when she was turned on. Secrets of female sexuality you never dreamed of, Gerald, she thought. Handcuff me to the bedposts and nothing happens. Show me a glass of water, though, and I turn into a raving nympho. The thought made her smile, and when the glass came to an abrupt halt, still a foot away from her face, slopping water onto her bare thigh and making it ripple with goose flesh, the smile stayed on at first. She felt nothing in those first few seconds but a species of stupid amazement and, incomprehension. What was wrong? What could be wrong?
You know what?
One of the UFO voices said. It spoke with a calm certainty Jessie found dreadful. Yes, she supposed she did know, somewhere inside, but she didn't want to let that knowledge step into the spotlight which was her conscious mind. Some truths were simply too harsh to be acknowledged, too unfair. Unfortunately, some truths were also self-evident. As Jessie gazed at the glass, her bloodshot, puffy eyes began to fill with horrified comprehension. The chain was the reason she wasn't getting her drink. The handcuffed chain was just too fucking short. The fact had been so obvious that she had missed it completely. Jessie suddenly found herself remembering the night George Bush had been elected president. She and Gerald had been invited to a posh celebration party in the Hotel Sinesta's rooftop restaurant. Senator William Cohen was the guest of honor, and the president-elect, Lonesome George himself, was expected to make a closed-circuit television call shortly before midnight. Gerald had hired a fog-colored limo for the occasion, and it had pulled into their driveway at 7 o'clock, dead on time, but at 10 past the hour she had still been sitting on the bed in her best black dress, rummaging through her jewelry box and cursing as she hunted for a special pair of gold earrings. Gerald had poked his head impatiently into the room to see what was holding her up, listened with that, "Why are you girls always so darn silly?" expression that she absolutely hated on his face, then said he wasn't sure, but he thought she was wearing the one she was looking for. She had been. It had made her feel small and stupid, a perfect justification for his patronizing expression. It had also made her feel like flying at him and knocking out his beautifully capped teeth with one of the sexy but exquisitely uncomfortable high-heel shoes she was wearing. What she had felt then was mild compared to what she was feeling now, however, and if anyone deserved getting their teeth knocked out, it was her. She thrust her head as far forward as she could, pooching her lips out like the heroine of some corny old black-and-white romance movie. She got so close to the glass that she could see tiny sprays of air bubbles caught in the last few slivers of ice. Close enough to actually smell the minerals in the well water, or to imagine she did. But she did not get quite close enough to drink from it. When she reached the point where she could simply stretch no further, her puckered kiss-me lips were still a good 4 inches from the glass. It was almost enough, but almost, as Gerald and her father as well, now that she thought about it, had been fond of saying, only counted in horseshoes. "I don't believe it," she heard herself saying in her new hoarse Scotch and Marlboro's voice. "I just don't believe it." Anger suddenly woke inside her and screamed at her in Ruth Neary's voice to throw the glass across the room. If she could not drink from it, Ruth's voice proclaimed harshly, she would punish it. If she could not satisfy her thirst with what was in it, she would at least satisfy her mind with the sound of it shattering to 1,000 bits against the wall. Her grip on the glass tightened, and the steel chain softened to a lax arc as she threw her hand back to do just that. Unfair! It was just so unfair! The voice which stopped her was the soft, tentative voice of Goodwife Burlingame. "Maybe there's a way, Jessie. Don't give up yet. Maybe there's still a way." Ruth still wanted her to throw the glass. Nora Callaghan would undoubtedly have said that Ruth was heavily invested in the concept of payback.
"Don't pay any attention to her," the good wife said. Her voice had lost its unusual tentative quality. It sounded almost excited now. "Put it back on the shelf, Jesse."
"And what then?" Ruth asked. "What then, O great white guru? O goddess of Tupperware and patron saint of the Church of Shop by Mail?"
Goody told her. And Ruth's voice fell silent, as Jesse and all the other voices inside her listened.
She put the glass back on the shelf carefully, taking care to make sure she didn't leave it hanging over the edge. Her tongue now felt like a piece of number 5 sandpaper, and her throat actually seemed infected with thirst. It reminded her of the way she had felt in the autumn of her 10th year, when a combined case of the flu and bronchitis had kept her out of school for a month and a half. There had been long nights during that siege when she had awakened from confused, jangling nightmares she couldn't remember. Except you can, Jesse. You dreamed about the smoked glass. You dreamed about how the sun went out. You dreamed about the flat and tearful smell that was like minerals in well water. You dreamed about his hands. And she was drenched with sweat, but felt too weak to reach for the pitcher of water on the bed table. She remembered lying there, wet and sticky and fever-smelling on the outside, parched and full of phantoms on the inside, lying there and thinking her real disease was not bronchitis but thirst. Now, all these years later, she felt exactly the same way. Her mind kept trying to return to the horrible moment when she had realized she wasn't going to be able to bridge the last sliver of distance between the glass and her mouth. She kept seeing the tiny sprays of air bubbles in the melting ice, kept smelling the faint aroma of minerals trapped in the aquifer far beneath the lake. These images taunted her like an unreasonable itch between the shoulder blades. Nevertheless, she made herself wait. The part of her that was Goody Burlingame said she needed to take some time in spite of the taunting images and her throbbing throat. She needed to wait for her heart to slow down, for her muscles to stop trembling, for her emotions to settle a bit. Outside, the last color was fading from the air. The world was going a solemn and melancholy gray. On the lake, the loon lifted its piercing cry into the evening gloom. "Shut your yap, Mr. Loon," Jesse said and chuckled. It sounded like a rusty hinge. "All right, dear," the good wife said. "I think it's time to try, before it gets dark. Better dry your hands again first, though." She cupped both hands around the bedposts this time, rubbing them up and down until they produced squeaks. She held up her right hand and wiggled it in front of her eyes. "They laughed when I sat down at the piano," she thought. Then carefully she reached just beyond the place where the glass stood on the edge of the shelf. She began to patter her fingers along the wood again. The handcuff chinked against the side of the glass once, and she froze, waiting for it to overturn. When it didn't, she resumed her cautious exploration. She had almost decided that what she was looking for had slid down the shelf or entirely off it, when she finally touched the corner of the blow-in card. She tweezed it between the first and second fingers of her right hand and brought it carefully up and away from the shelf and the glass. Jessie steadied her grip on the card with her thumb and looked at it curiously. It was bright purple, with noisemakers dancing tipsily along the upper edge. Confetti and streamers drifted down between the words. Newsweek was celebrating big, big savings, the card announced, and it wanted her to join the party. Newsweek's writers would keep her up to date on world events, take her behind the scenes with world leaders, and offer her in-depth coverage of arts, politics, and the sporting life. Although it did not come right out and say so, the card pretty much implied that Newsweek could help Jesse make sense of the entire cosmos. Best of all, those lovable lunatics in Newsweek's subscription department were offering a deal so amazing it could make your urine steam and your head explode. If she used this very card to subscribe to Newsweek for 3 years, she would get each issue at less than half the newsstand price. And was money a problem? Absolutely not. You would be billed later. I wonder if they have direct bed service for handcuffed ladies, Jesse thought. Maybe with George Will or Jane Bryant Quinn or one of those other pompous old poops to turn the pages for me. Handcuffs make doing that so dreadfully difficult, you know. Yet below the sarcasm, she felt a species of odd, nervous wonder, and she couldn't seem to stop studying the purple card with its Let's Have a Party motif, its blanks for her name and address, and its little squares marked DICL, MC, Visa, and Amex. I've been cursing these cards all my life, especially when I have to bend over and pick one of the damn things up, or see myself as just another litter bug, without ever guessing that my sanity, maybe even my life, might depend on one someday. Her life? Was that really possible? Did she actually have to admit such a horrid idea into her calculations after all? Jessie was reluctantly coming to believe that she did. She might be here for quite a while before someone discovered her, and yes, she supposed it was just barely possible that the difference between life and death could come down to a single drink of water. The idea was surreal, but it no longer seemed patently ridiculous. Same thing as before, dear. Slow and easy wins the race. Yes. But who would ever have believed the finish line would turn out to be situated in such weird countryside? She did move slowly and carefully, however, and was relieved to discover that manipulating the blow-in card one-handed was not as difficult as she feared it might be. This was partly because it was about 6 inches by 4, almost the size of 2 playing cards laid side by side, but mostly because she wasn't trying to do anything very tricky with it. She held the card lengthwise between her first and second fingers, then used her thumb to bend the last half inch of the long side all the way down. The fold wasn't even, but she thought it would serve. Besides, nobody was going to come along and judge her work. Brownie Crafts Hour on Thursday nights at the First Methodist Church of Falmouth was long behind her now. She pinched the purple card firmly between her first 2 fingers again and folded over another half inch. It took her almost 3 minutes and 7 foldovers to get to the end of the card. When she finally did, she had something that looked like a bomber joint, clumsily rolled in jaunty purple paper. Or if you stretched your imagination a little, a straw. Jessie stuck it in her mouth, trying to hold the crooked folds together with her teeth. When she had it as firmly as she thought she was going to get it, she began feeling around for the glass again. Stay careful, Jessie. Don't spoil it all with impatience now. Thanks for the advice. Also, thanks for the idea. It was great. I really mean that. Now, however, I'd like you to shut up long enough for me to take my shot. Okay? When her fingertips touched the smooth surface of the glass, she slid them around it with the gentleness and caution of a young lover slipping her hand into her boyfriend's fly for the first time. Gripping the glass in its new position was a relatively simple matter. She brought it around and lifted it as far as the chain would allow. The last slivers of ice had melted, she saw. Tempest had gone fugiting merrily along, despite her feeling that it had stopped dead in its tracks around the time the dog had put in its first appearance. But she wouldn't think about the dog. In fact, she was going to work hard at believing that no dog had ever been there. You're good at unhappening things. Aren't you, Tootsie Wootsie? Hey, Ruth, I'm trying to keep a grip on myself as well as the damn glass in case you hadn't noticed. If playing a few mind games helps me do that, I don't see what the big deal is. Just shut up for a while, okay? Give it a rest. Let me get on with my business. Ruth apparently had no intention of giving it a rest, however. Shut up, she marveled. Boy, how that takes me back. It's better than a Beach Boys oldie on the radio. You always did give good shut-up, Jessie. Remember that night in the dorm after we came back from your first and last consciousness-raising session at Newworth? I don't want to remember, Ruth. I'm sure you don't. So I'll remember for both of us. How's that for a deal? You kept saying it was the girl with the scars on her breasts that had upset you. Only that and nothing more. But when I tried to tell you what you said in the kitchen, about how you and your father had been alone at your place on Darkscore Lake when the sun went out in 1963, and how he'd done something to you, you told me to shut up. When I wouldn't, you tried to slap me. When I still wouldn't, you grabbed your coat, ran out, and spent the night somewhere else, probably in Susie Timmel's little flea-bag cabin down the river, the one we used to call Susie's Les Hotel. By the end of the week, you'd found some girls who had an apartment downtown and needed another roomie. Boom. As fast as that. But then, you always moved fast when you made up your mind, Jess. I'll give you that. And like I said, you always gave good shut-up. Shut! There, what did I tell you? Leave me alone! I'm pretty familiar with that one, too. You know what hurt me the most, Jesse? It wasn't the trust thing. I knew even then that it was nothing personal, that you felt you couldn't trust anyone with the story of what happened that day, including yourself. What hurt was knowing how close you came to spilling it all, there in the kitchen of the Newworth parsonage. We were sitting with our backs against the door and our arms around each other, and you started to talk. You said, "I could never tell. It would have killed my mom. And even if it didn't, she would have left him, and I loved him. We all loved him. We all needed him. They would have blamed me, and he didn't do anything. Not really." I asked you who didn't do anything. "My father," you said. We were at Darkscore Lake on the day the sun went out. You would have told me the rest. I know you would. But that was when that dumb bitch came in and asked, "Is she all right?" As if you looked all right. You know what I mean? Jesus, sometimes I can't believe how dumb people can be. They ought to make it a law that you have to get a license, or at least a learner's permit, before you're allowed to talk. Until you pass your talker's test, you should have to be a mute. It would solve a lot of problems. But that's not the way things are. And as soon as Hart Hall's answer to Florence Nightingale came in, you closed up like a clam. There was nothing I could do to make you open up again, although God knows I tried.
"You should have just left me alone,"
Jessie returned. The glass of water was starting to shake in her hand, and the makeshift purple straw was trembling between her lips.
"You should have stopped meddling. It didn't concern you."
"Sometimes friends can't help their concern, Jesse," the voice inside said, and it was so full of kindness that Jesse was silenced. "I looked it up, you know. I figured out what you must have been talking about, and I looked it up. I didn't remember anything at all about an eclipse back in the early 60s. But of course I was in Florida at the time and a lot more interested in snorkeling and the Del Rey lifeguard. I had the most incredible crush on him than I was in astronomical phenomena. I guess I wanted to make sure the whole thing wasn't some kind of crazy fantasy or something, maybe brought on by that girl with the horrible burns on her bazooms. It was no fantasy. There was a total solar eclipse in Maine, and your summer house on Darkscore Lake would have been right in the path of totality. July of 1963. Just a girl and her dad, watching the eclipse. You wouldn't tell me what good old dad did to you, but I knew two things, Jesse. That he was your father, which was bad, and that you were 10 going on 11, on the childhood rim of puberty. And that was worse. Ruth, please stop. You couldn't have picked a worse time to start raking up all that old... But Ruth would not be stopped. Ruth, who had once been Jesse's roommate, had always been determined to have her say every single word of it. And the Ruth who was now Jesse's headmate apparently hadn't changed a bit. The next thing I knew, you were living off campus with three little sorority Susies, princesses in A-line jumpers and ship-and-shore blouses, each undoubtedly owning a set of those underpants with the days of the week sewn on them. I think you made a conscious decision to go into training for the Olympic dusting and floor waxing team right around then. You unhappened that night at the Newworth Parsonage. You unhappened the tears and the hurt and the anger. You unhappened me. Oh, we still saw each other once in a while. Split the occasional pizza and pitcher of Molson's down at Pat's. But our friendship was really over, wasn't it? When it came down to a choice between me and what happened to you in July of 1963, you chose the eclipse. The glass of water was trembling harder.
Why now, Ruth? She asked, unaware that she was actually mouthing the words in the darkening bedroom.
Why now? That's what I want to know. Given that in this incarnation you're really a part of me, why now? Why at the exact time when I can least afford being upset and distracted? The most obvious answer to that question was also the most unappetizing, because there was an enemy inside. A sad, bad bitch who liked her just the way she was, handcuffed, aching, thirsty, scared, and miserable, just fine. Who didn't want to see that condition alleviated in the slightest. Who would stoop to any dirty trick to see that it wasn't. The total solar eclipse lasted just over a minute that day, Jesse. Except in your mind. In there, it's still going on, isn't it? She closed her eyes and focused all her thought and will on steadying the glass in her hand. Now she spoke mentally to Ruth's voice without self-consciousness, as if she really were speaking to another person, instead of to a part of her brain that had suddenly decided this was the right time to do a little work on herself, as Nora Callaghan would have put it. Let me alone, Ruth. If you still want to discuss these things after I've taken a stab at getting a drink, okay. But for now, will you please just... Shut the fuck up, she finished in a low whisper. Yes, Ruth replied at once. I know there's something or someone inside you, trying to throw dirt in the works. And I know it sometimes uses my voice. It's a great ventriloquist, no doubt about that. But it's not me. I loved you then, and I love you now. That was why I kept trying to stay in touch with you as long as I did. Because I loved you. And I suppose because us high-riding bitches have to stick together. Jesse smiled a little, or tried to, around the makeshift straw. Now go for it, Jesse, and go hard. Jesse waited for a moment, but there was nothing else. Ruth was gone, at least for the time being. She opened her eyes again, then slowly bent her head forward, the rolled-up card jutting out of her mouth like FDR's cigarette holder. Please, God, I'm begging you, let this work. Her makeshift straw slid into the water. Jessie closed her eyes and sucked. For a moment there was nothing, and clear despair rose up in her mind. Then water filled her mouth, cool and sweet and there, surprising her into a kind of ecstasy. She would have sobbed with gratitude if her mouth hadn't been so strenuously puckered around the end of the rolled-up subscription card. As it was, she could only make a foggy hooting sound through her nose. She swallowed the water, feeling it coating her throat like liquid satin, and then began to suck again. She did this as ardently and as mindlessly as a hungry calf working at its mother's teat. Her straw was a long way from perfect, delivering only sips and slurps and rills instead of a steady stream, and most of what she was sucking into the tube was spilling out again from the imperfect seals and crooked folds. On some level she knew this, could hear water pattering to the coverlet like raindrops, but her grateful mind still fervently believed that her straw was one of the greatest inventions ever created by the mind of woman, and that this moment, this drink from her dead husband's water glass, was the apogee of her life. Don't drink it all, Jess. Save some for later. She didn't know which one of her phantom companions had spoken this time, and it didn't matter. Sometimes she was discovering it was impossible to take the mind's advice, no matter how good it was. Sometimes the body simply rose up and slapped all that good advice aside. She was discovering something else as well. Giving in to those simple physical needs could be an inexpressible relief. Jesse went on sucking through the rolled-up card, tilting the glass to keep the surface of the water brimming over the far end of the soggy, misshapen purple thing, aware in some part of her mind that the card was leaking worse than ever, and she was insane not to stop and wait for it to dry out again, but going on anyway. What finally stopped her was the realization that she was sucking nothing but air, and had been for several seconds. There was water left in Gerald's glass, but the tip of her makeshift straw would no longer quite touch it. The coverlet beneath the rolled-up blow-in card was dark with moisture. I could get what's left, though, I could, if I could turn my hand a little farther in that unnatural backward direction I needed to get hold of the miserable glass in the first place. I think I can stick my neck a little farther forward to get those last few sips of water. Think I can? I know I can. She did know it, and later on she would test the idea. But for now, the white-collar guys on the top floor, the one with all the good views, had once again wrested control away from the day laborers and shop stewards who ran the machinery. The mutiny was over. Her thirst was a long way from being entirely slaked, but her throat had quit throbbing and she felt a lot better, mentally as well as physically. Sharper in her thoughts and marginally brighter in her outlook. She found she was glad she'd left that last little bit in the glass. Two sips of water through a leaky straw probably wouldn't spell the difference between remaining handcuffed to the bed and finding a way to wiggle out of this mess on her own, let alone between life and death. But getting those last couple of sips might occupy her mind when and if it tried to turn to its own morbid devices again. After all, night was coming. Her husband was lying dead on the floor beside her, and it looked like she was camping out. Not a pretty picture, especially when you added the hungry stray who was camping out with her. But Jessie found she was growing sleepy again just the same. She tried to think of reasons to fight her growing drowsiness, and couldn't come up with any good ones. Even the thought of waking up with her arms numb to the elbows didn't seem like a particularly big deal. She would simply move them around until the blood was flowing briskly again. It wouldn't be pleasant, but she had no doubt about her ability to do it. "Also, you might have an idea while you're asleep, dear," Goodwife Burlingame said. "That always happens in books." "Maybe you will," Jessie said. "After all, you've had the best one so far." She let herself lie down, using her shoulder blades to scrunch the pillow as far up against the head of the bed as she could. Her shoulders ached, her arms, especially the left one, throbbed, and her stomach muscles were still fluttering with the strain of holding her upper body far enough forward to drink through the straw. But she felt strangely content just the same, at peace with herself. Content? How can you feel content? Your husband is dead, after all, and you played a part in that, Jesse. And suppose you are found. Suppose you are rescued. Have you thought about how the situation is going to look to whoever finds you? How do you suppose it's going to look to Constable Teagarden, as far as that goes? How long do you think it will take him to decide to call the state police? 30 seconds? Maybe 40? They think a little slower out here in the country, though, don't they? It might take him all of 2 minutes. She couldn't argue with any of that. It was true. Then how can you feel content, Jesse? How can you possibly feel content with things like that hanging over you? She didn't know, but she did. Her sense of tranquility was as deep as a feather bed on the night a March gale filled with sleet roars out of the northwest, and as warm as the goose-down comforter on that bed. She suspected that most of this feeling stemmed from causes which were purely physical. If you were thirsty enough, it was apparently possible to get stoned on half a glass of water. But there was a mental side as well. 10 years ago, she had reluctantly given up her job as a substitute teacher, finally giving in to the pressure of Gerald's persistent, or maybe relentless was the word she was actually looking for, logic. He was making almost $100,000 a year by then, Next to that, her 5 to 7 grand looked pretty paltry. It was, in fact, an actual annoyance at tax time, when the IRS took most of it, and then went sniffing over their financial records, wondering where the rest of it was. When she complained about their suspicious behavior, Gerald had looked at her with a mixture of love and exasperation. It wasn't quite his, "Why are you girls so silly?" expression. That one didn't start to show up regularly for another 5 or 6 years, but it was close. "They see what I'm making," he told her. "They see 2 large German cars in the garage, they look at the pictures of the place and the lake, and then they look at your tax forms, and they see you're working for what they think of as chump change. They can't believe it. It looks phony to them, a cover for something. So they go snooping around, looking for whatever that something else might be. They don't know you like I do, that's all." She had been unable to explain to Gerald what the substitute contract meant to her. Or maybe it was that he had been unwilling to listen. Either way, it came to the same. Teaching, even on a part-time basis, filled her up in some important way, and Gerald didn't get that. Nor had he been able to get the fact that subbing formed a bridge to the life that she had lived before she'd met Gerald at that Republican mixer, when she'd been a full-time English teacher at Waterville High, a woman on her own who was working for a living, who was well-liked and respected by her colleagues, and who was beholden to no one. She had been unable to explain, or he had been unwilling to listen, how quitting teaching, even on that final part-time piecework basis, made her feel mournful and lost and somehow useless. That rudderless feeling, probably caused as much by her inability to catch pregnant as by her decision to return her contract unsigned, had departed from the surface of her mind after a year or so, but it had never entirely left the deeper ranges of her heart. She had sometimes felt like a cliché to herself, young teacher lady wed successful lawyer, whose name goes up on the door at the tender, professionally speaking, that is, age of 30. This young, well, relatively young woman eventually steps into the foyer of that puzzle palace known as middle age, looks around, and finds she is suddenly all alone, no job, no kids, and a husband who is almost completely focused, one wouldn't want to say fixated, that might be accurate, but it would also be unkind, on climbing that fabled ladder of success. This woman, suddenly faced with 40 just beyond the next bend in the road, is exactly the sort of woman most likely to get in trouble with drugs, booze, or another man. A younger man, usually. None of that happened to this young, well, previously young woman, but Jessie still found herself with a scary amount of time on her hands. Time to garden, time to go mauling, time to take classes, the painting, the sculpture, the poetry. And she could have had an affair with a man who taught the poetry if she wanted to, and she had almost wanted to. There had also been time to do a little work on herself, which was how she had happened to meet Nora. Yet not one of those things had left her feeling the way she felt now, as though her weariness and aches were badges of valor, and her sleepiness a justly won reward. The handcuffed lady's version of Miller time, you might say. "Hey, Jess. The way you got that water was pretty great." It was another UFO, but this time Jesse didn't mind. Just as long as Ruth didn't show up for a while. Ruth was interesting, but she was also exhausting. "A lot of people would never have even gotten the glass," her UFO fan continued. "And using the blow-in card for a straw, that was a masterstroke. So go ahead and feel good. It's allowed. A little nap is allowed, too."
"But the dog," Goody said doubtfully.
"That dog isn't going to bother you one damned bit. And you know why."
Yes. The reason the dog wasn't going to bother her was lying nearby on the bedroom floor. Gerald was now nothing but a shadow among shadows, for which Jessie was grateful. Outside, the wind gusted again. The sound of it hissing through the pines was comforting, lulling. Jessie closed her eyes.
"But be careful what you dream,"
Goody called after her in sudden alarm. But her voice was distant and not terribly compelling. Still, it tried again.
"Be careful what you dream, Jessie. I'm serious."
Yes, of course she was. The good wife was always serious, which meant she was also often tiresome. Whatever I dream, Jesse thought, it won't be that I'm thirsty. I haven't had many clear victories over the last 10 years, mostly one murky guerrilla engagement after another. But getting that drink of water was a clear win, wasn't it? Yes, the UFO voice agreed. It was a vaguely masculine voice, and she found herself wondering in a sleepy way if perhaps it was the voice of her brother Will. Will as he'd been as a child, back in the 60s.
You bet it was. It was great.
5 minutes later, Jesse was sleeping deeply, arms up and splayed in a limp V-shape, wrists held loosely to the bedpost by the handcuffs, head lolling against her right shoulder, the less painful one, long, slow snores drifting from her mouth. And at some point, long after dark had fallen and a white rind of moon had risen in the east, the dog appeared in the doorway again. Like Jesse, it was calmer now that its most immediate need had been met, and the clamor in its stomach had been stilled to some extent. It gazed at her raptly for a long time, with its good ear cocked and its muzzle up, trying to decide if she was really asleep or only pretending. It decided, mostly on the basis of smell, the sweat which was now drying, the total absence of the crackling ozone stink of adrenaline, that she was asleep. There would be no kicks or shouts this time, not if it was careful not to wake her up. The dog padded softly to the heap of meat in the middle of the floor. Although its hunger was now less, the meat actually smelled better. This was because its first meal had gone a long way toward breaking down the ancient, inbred taboo against this sort of meat, although the dog did not know this and wouldn't have cared if it did. It lowered its head, first sniffing the now attractive aroma of the dead lawyer with all the delicacy of a gourmet. Then closing its teeth gently on Gerald's lower lip, it pulled, applying pressure slowly, stretching the flesh further and further. Gerald began to look as if he were deep in some monstrous pout. The lip finally tore off, revealing his bottom teeth in a big dead grin. The dog swallowed the small delicacy in a single gulp, then licked its chops. Its tail began to wag again, this time moving in slow, contented sweeps. Two tiny spots of light danced on the ceiling high above, moonlight reflected from the fillings in two of Gerald's lower molars. These fillings had been done only the week before, and they were still as fresh and shiny as newly minted quarters. The dog licked its chops a second time, looking lovingly at Gerald as it did so. Then it stretched its neck forward, almost exactly as Jessie had stretched hers in order to finally plop her straw into the glass. The dog sniffed Gerald's face, but it did not just sniff. It allowed its nose to go on a kind of olfactory vacation there, first sampling the faint floor-polishy aroma of brown wax buried deep in the dead master's left ear, then the intermingled odors of sweat and prell at the hairline, then the sharp, entrancingly bitter smell of clotted blood on the crown of Gerald's head. It lingered especially long at Gerald's nose, conducting a delicate investigation into those now tideless channels with its scratched, dirty, but oh-so-sensitive muzzle. Again, there was that sense of gourmandizing, a feeling that the dog was choosing among many unexpected treasures. At last it sank its sharp teeth deeply into Gerald's left cheek, clamped them together, and began to pull. On the bed, Jessie's eyes had begun to move rapidly back and forth behind her lids, and now she moaned, a high, wavering sound full of terror and recognition. The dog looked up once, its body dropping into an instinctive cringe of guilt and fear. It didn't last long. Already it had begun to see this pile of meat not as something forbidden, approachable only in the toils of hunger and approaching starvation, but as its private larder, for which it would fight, and perhaps die if challenged. Besides, it was only the bitchmaster making that sound, and the dog was now quite sure that the bitchmaster was powerless. It dipped its head down, seized Gerald Burlingame's cheek once more, and yanked backwards, shaking its head briskly from side to side as it did so. A long strip of the dead man's cheek came free with a sound like strapping tape being pulled briskly off the dispenser roll. Gerald now wore the ferocious, predatory smile of a man who has just filled a straight flush in a high-stakes poker game. Jesse moaned again. The sound was followed by a string of guttural, unintelligible sleep talk. The dog glanced up at her once more. It was sure she couldn't get off the bed and bother it, but those sounds made it uneasy just the same. The old taboo had faded, but it hadn't disappeared. Besides, its hunger was sated. What it was doing now wasn't eating, but snacking. It turned and trotted out of the room again. Most of Gerald's left cheek dangled from its mouth like the scalp of an infant.